from tragedy to triumph. Hosted by Aaron Lane.
Everyone, welcome to this episode of Tragedy to Triumph. I have my good friend Jesse with me today, and Jesse has been through a lot. We've been friends for a bit. He's a man in long-term recovery, over a year now, and you can do a little something different. I mean, considering, you know, our walks of life, you know, things that happened to us in childhood may be able to shape why we become addicts and why we struggle in any area. And Jesse, what I would like for the listeners is to kind of paint this picture of, like, you know, and you can sum it up, like, what your childhood was like.
Well, I moved around a lot, moved around the country a lot. My parents were, my dad mostly was very involved with the church, Christianity, religious. And I was homeschooled by my mother for the first 10 years or till age 10, I should say.
Okay.
So I was sheltered, grew up with a lot of fear of, you know, the outside world, I guess, and kind of in leaning towards more of the cult type of church.
Right.
It wasn't really normal. We go on Sundays. It was like you're, you know, being groomed to become a prophet, really. And I was not into that. That was my dad's plan. That's what, you know, what he wanted from us. And he kind of pushed what his idea of what a good Christian looked like on us. And when we didn't meet that, we would be verbally abused, and there was no satisfying what he, you know, so it was never, we were never good enough in his eyes. How we were religiously or whatever he felt we were doing wrong at the time.
And that's a shitty way to grow up, man, just to never be good enough to somebody. But as a result, you wanted, because I know that we have this in common where we people please too. So we don't want, you know, I think there's some of that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up with a fear of abandonment, wanting to people please. So going along with the crowd to do whatever was going on. And that generally was things that our parents, you know, didn't want us to do, which drinking, partying, you know, whose parents were out of town for the weekend. Let's go party at their place. And so it kind of just started out innocent and normal, and drinking on the weekends. But then it
snowballed.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, but I know we've talked about it before, and you said you got some like underage drinking tickets, and you know, there were some issues at home. Your parents got divorced when you were in high school, right? Or towards
your
end of high school?
Yep. They were separated and finalized their divorce the year I graduated. So it was kind of like, overshadowed me graduating high school and preparing me to move on to college. And I didn't want to, you know, it was like, I felt like I didn't want to bother them with me, you know,
right,
becoming an adult. So I was like, no, you know, you don't need to help me. I got this. And so I kind of wanted to be like this independent, move off to college on my own. And I rented the U-Haul and drove myself down there with the truck full of crap that I don't know what happened to any of it. But, you know, I didn't want to be a burden on them, and I felt like I was a burden. I go from not being good enough to now being a burden to, you know, and so it was like drugs and, you know, alcohol were waiting with open arms.
Right.
We got you. That. We can make you feel better.
And that's what they did, right? I mean, a lot of people seem to forget, like, the reason I used is because it made me feel better, right? It just did. And I think most people, you go out and you have a couple drinks. It's fun. It enhances the night. It's a celebratory thing. It's a coping mechanism for a lot of people. Like, I've had a long day or a long week at work or whatever,
yeah,
right?
Work, so there's shit.
Right. So I'm going to go ahead and have a couple drinks.
You make best friends. Every night you got a best friend. Wow, I got a best friend. You make these like bullshit plans that you obviously never do anything about, right, but you're making plans and you're solving the world's issues. And, you know,
would you say, like, when you went to college, what was your goal in college? What did you want to be?
Initially, I went for, I was in the school, College of Business, and I wanted, well, I was going for computer science. I took a couple C++ and Visual Basics and programming and some upper math. I was really good at math. And then I was in the business school to complement. I wanted to program and
be a tech god or something.
Yeah,
right?
Tech, you know, kind of.
Guru.
Yeah, maybe writing program. I don't know. I wanted to, like, write software for businesses or something. You know,
right, it was, and they had, like, the next big thing. And, you know, when that's admirable, right?
Yeah, the internet was new, you know, back then.
Right.
Which is weird. But that's, you know, it was a booming business, and so
all
I wanted to get into it.
Yeah. So now you're in college, and, you know, would you call it a habit, a drinking habit at that point in time? Or was it just like something still like, let's just have some drinks. I'm in college. This is the time of my life.
I think I didn't go to one class my first semester.
That's actually really funny.
Mean, I was addicted to like making friends and like feeling normal. And so I didn't live in the dorms. I lived off campus right away with people. Everyone, all my roommates were all 21. So I think I had a fake ID within a few months of moving down. And so it was like, I really didn't do school much. My second semester was a lot better.
You started showing
following
up.
Years and stuff. But yeah, the first one I was like cutting loose, you know.
Well, maybe in a lot of ways, because now all of a sudden you're free.
Yeah.
Would you say that? I mean, this is, you're a young adult. Some people would say kid. I'd say young adult because I remember what it's like being 18, 19. I mean, we think we know it all. Mm-hmm. And it's acceptable because you're out of school. People party in college. I mean, all of that. Like, it's part of the environment.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So now you're doing that and you're partying a bit. You didn't go to school the first semester, really.
Yeah.
So just kind of getting your sea legs or whatever.
Yeah, testing the water.
There you go. What happens from there?
Well, I've always been into music because my upbringing, my dad was very musical. I've always been into like electronic music. So I started DJing right away. I think my neighbors would throw, this is back in the 90s, and their raving was like a big thing back
then.
Yeah,
it was.
So I started to spin records, and I learned how to spin records, aided with crystal meth.
Really?
It was like it really helped you focus.
Where'd you go
for
to school?
A while?
Yeah, it does.
University of Wisconsin.
So University of Wisconsin. Meth is a part of the picture.
Yeah, I would bounce back and forth up to Minneapolis.
Crank at the time, right?
They were calling it crank. Bathtub crank, whatever, you know, glass, whatever I could get my hands on.
Right.
You know? But it wasn't like too much. It was that
just
was,
to make you like, hey, I'm a party all night. We
yeah,
got this.
I didn't. I hated the come down, and it was, I knew it was coming, and I was like, the more I did, I knew that the withdrawal would be worse. So I really, you know, I would use it as like a study aid, I guess. And I didn't really like overdo anything like too much. I mean, I was drinking daily, but I wasn't like,
wasn't really ever doing anything, but I was drinking.
And
every day.
You know, when I look back, yeah, I was like constantly smoking weed and, you know,
you're good.
I didn't just go overboard I did later, you know. I was still, like, doing stuff and planning trips and, you know, whatever.
Saving the world, as you said. Did you have a DJ name?
Yeah, I was Cloudy McSteam Trough. Yeah. And then...
How did you come up on that?
I don't know. It was like everyone was...
Say
I just,
that one more time. Cloudy McSteam Trough. Like a trough that pigs
trough.
Go?
Yeah, trough.
Oh my gosh.
Cloudy McSteam Trough. It was like everyone else was using like DJ.
DJ Johnny
something,
Blue
you know, like right. Short names. And I like when it was on a flyer, it was like when it was printed out on the flyer, it was really long and looked stupid. So I was like, yeah, that's it.
That's what we're going to do.
We nailed it.
Did you come up with that idea on meth?
No, I don't. I was probably on something. I don't remember what.
What else were you using? Any psychedelics?
I mean... Mushrooms, acid, that was regular. Weed constantly. Coke, if I could, you know, everything. It was anything in front of me. Smorgasbord of whatever. That's trough, what it was.
The trough. And you just, you know, living. I find that so funny. So here you have this childhood, you know, that is toxic in a lot of ways and did, you know, made you feel some type of way. You get to college. You're a smart guy. You've always been very bright. And you're there, and it's the time to experiment. And you're like, I'm going to try it all.
Yeah, and so, like, that desire to be accepted and to... So I was, you know, drugs became, like, something that people would call me about. And they liked to have me around because I knew where to get the stuff.
Right.
And so that and I was a DJ, you know, and so I knew where the big party was, you know, and I worked at a couple different clubs. And I was a resident, you know, they call it a resident DJ at one club every Tuesday night. You know, I didn't get Friday or Saturday, but I didn't play top 40 stuff. I wasn't a top 40.
You had a Tuesday, you had a steady gig to DJ. And
yeah.
I mean, and I know this because, you know, when I was 17 and 18 years old, or 17 turning into 18, graduating high school, I was a barback and bouncer in downtown Cincinnati at the clubs,
mm-hmm.
and that became a huge part of my life right off the bat. The moment I got out of high school, this whole new world opened up to me,
yeah.
and I loved it, staying up until, you know, 6 a.m., partying, you know, meeting women, doing all sorts of things, underage drinking, because everybody that I'm hanging out with, this is the scene, and it's a lot of fun.
And it was my identity, and it was, and it, you know, all, like, people I grew up with were moving on with their lives, growing up, getting married, whatever, starting families. And I was, like, going down this dark road, you know. And it was, like, in my mind, I'm convincing myself, well, there's no turning back now. I mean,
right, I'm here.
You know, I'm doing this. This is what I'm doing.
So, so you graduated. Did you ever graduate college, first and foremost?
No.
So why not?
I just...
Partying too much, or...
No, I really liked being in school, and I switched majors. I just went with, like, a general no major, and I just liked taking classes. I went part-time for, like, 7 years. I just never just took, like, one or two classes at a time just because I liked learning stuff.
I believe that. I know that you're well-read. You've always liked your...
But I think it was, like, a pride thing. Like, I had to at least have some semblance of a normal life, or like make it look like I had a plan, but I really didn't have any plan.
Okay.
Yeah. Like I'm just
kind of interesting. You just think here for a second. I mean, cause you brought up before, about keeping up appearances too. Like, I mean that your family did that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And now you're kind of repeating the same thing in a lot of ways. Your life is messed up, right? For all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
And you said you're headed down this dark path, not as dark as it, when we'll get there.
Yeah.
But you maintained, you know, going to school so that when maybe even through conversation, family, whoever, that, yeah, I'm still a student.
Yeah. This class I'm taking, we're learning about, you know, so it just sounds smart when you're at like some, you know, like you sound, you know.
Like so it's like very ego. It's interesting.
Yeah, narcissistic.
You realize how much bullshit it is.
Yeah.
But you were able to continue doing it.
Yeah.
And you did that for a while. And now you're in school. You're partying, DJing, meeting new people, experimenting with different drugs.
Yep.
In that period, what were some like notable things you're like, this is insane?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of that.
But what's the first thing that comes to mind?
First thing that comes to mind, I mean, this is like later on, I'm moved on from, the college phase. I moved out west. I moved to Portland.
Oh yeah. Oregon. Portland's weird, right?
Oh yeah. it was weird, you know, like a lot of my friends from college were moving out that direction. Yeah, and I didn't have any plan. I had, you know, I think I had a few thousand dollars in the bank, and I had a car, and that was my plan.
Why Portland, though? Do you remember?
A couple other friends were moving there, and it wasn't like I wasn't like planning to stay there. I was like that was the landing pad,
right?
I guess.
I guess you're saying.
And then my cousin was there. She had lived there for a long time. Like she went.
So you had a reason to go. And you're like, well, let me just experience this.
My aunt and uncle were up in Olympia. And so I had some family out there that, you know, if I fucked myself over too much, then right. I wouldn't be able to go mooch off of them for a minute, which I didn't need to really, because I, you know, I had this car and I started sleeping in it, and I wasn't on anything more than, you know, I wasn't on heroin yet, basically. And, but I was like training myself to be homeless.
Okay. Right. And you didn't even need to be there.
And I'd
right?
never like this is like I moved out there and the first time I slept in my car, it was like I felt like different the next day. I was like, I don't need a bed. I can sleep in this car, get some rest, and start my day again.
Yeah, like,
and it was like
my
I was okay
my
with
car.
It. Yeah, I was okay with it. I was like, this is weird. I can live in my car.
It's like an epiphany you hit one night. Like, you know, whatever reason you woke up and said, I'm okay with this.
Yeah. You know?
It's wild if you think about it, right? Looking at it now, you're saying that this is all I need, because your bed is a car and your car is a bed, and you just wake up, turn the ignition, you're ready to rock and roll, brush your teeth as you're
Hang
driving.
Some
maybe.
Sheets up in the, you know,
That's
so people
I'm
can't
saying.
Look in at me.
So, so now you're in Portland living in your car pretty quickly.
Yeah, immediately. No you plan. Know, I moved no there plan. With no plan. So there was no like, job lined up. There was no apartment or living situation lined up. I did have a job lined up. I had an interview. And so I got the job, you know. I moved out there with an interview and I got the job, which I've always been really good at interviewing. Like if I get an interview with an employer, I'm probably going to get the job. That's just because I interview really well, I guess.
But anyway, what was the thing that sticks out in your head though? So you're in Portland. This is
story. So it's just everything's escalating. It's all like the drugs are getting more, they're getting harder. I'm starting to dabble with heroin. I fully get addicted to heroin.
How were you introduced to that? Just by being in Portland?
So there's a lot of dancers out there. One of my friends from high school was a dancer, a stripper,
right.
And, she was dating, there are a lot of famous rock bands out there too. There's all this music scene and stuff.
Grunge scene.
There's like, it's a really huge music scene. And, so she was dating the bassist from Everclear, and, he was, you know, they were on the spiral down phase of their career where, you know, they weren't that big of a band, but they partied really hard like rock stars. So he like needed a roommate to help like pay his mortgage, and he had this room available. And so I'm living with this guy from Everclear, and, you know, obviously we're, you know, doing lots of drugs, and he's like famous. So you know, I was like in his entourage basically. And, you know, that was kind of,
it's so that, weird.
That was, yeah. Okay. But then, so after that, I think he threw me out for some reason. I think I hit on one of his girlfriends or something like that. And he was the king. So, you know, I couldn't, you know.
Yeah. The king of the castle, you don't, right.
Yeah. And he had a bunch of girlfriends and I didn't think it would be a big deal, but I hit on one of them. And so like, you know, he threw me out. And so now I'm back in my car. Let's just fast forward a couple years. I'm now on heroin. And, you know, when you're on drugs, your whole life is, you know, centered around getting and using.
Right.
And so anything that could put us closer to the source of the drugs, you know, my heroin dealer had this guy, this meth dealer living in an RV. He had an RV parked in front of his house with like a extension cord running out to it. And, you know, the guy on meth was constantly like taking things apart and trying to fix like engines, but, you know, was
right,
really
just
destroying everything. Yeah. So we get in with this guy and he needs help and he's got like money. So we're like trying to help him out with this, you know, he's always got this huge wad of cash. His name is Cuba. And he's like, he apparently escaped from Guantanamo Bay and was a boxer and killed a bunch of people, like serial killer, basically kills people. He's telling my girlfriend and I this, like, he's killed multiple people all over the country. Like he, you know, he's living in this weird ass RV. And so,
you're like, what did I get myself into?
So like, you know, my heroin dealer, he's like, okay, he's like, Cuba, listen, this is getting too hot over here. This is too crazy. You're going to have to move this RV. So he like moves this RV to, like a storage parking lot where people, you know, store their boats and stuff. But he's like parking this thing in the storage lot and living out of it. And we're still like in there, you know, helping him out with, you know, doing whatever. And, we're going back and forth to our heroin dealer and, we're like living in this RV with him. And I remember like sleeping in the front of it on this like futon with my girlfriend. And he was in the back, like there's a bed all the way in the back. And I remember like late at night, it was like rocking back and forth. Like he was trying to creep up towards us. And this was happening pretty regularly. And then, my heroin dealer's like, hey dude, he's trying to kill you and he wants to pimp out your girlfriend. And I was like, huh? Holy shit. You know? And he's like, yeah, you need to like get out of there. And so, you know, at least he was looking out for me. And he's like, this guy is serious about the people he's, you know.
Well, he's a tweaker.
He's a tweaker. Insane. He's probably actually killed people.
Right. And probably has. And, yeah. And you get word from your heroin dealer that he wants to off you and pimp out your girlfriend.
Yes. Like this was his plan.
This is your life. I just want to let the listeners know that this is your life.
Yeah, this really. Yeah, this was it.
This is like the Breaking Bad RV with, you know, one guy, the tweaker in the back, taking stuff apart, thinking about murder. You're living it. You're staying with him because it's a place to stay.
Yeah.
And steady stream of drugs.
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
Yep.
You have everything you need because you have a girlfriend, really, and you guys are probably like partners in crime, you know, Bonnie and Clyde thing, right?
Well, this is like, you know, the later.
But it doesn't matter whether it's later or not. I'm just saying, like, this is your life here. And this is the insane stuff that people, like, you could have never, being homeschooled, growing up, ever anticipated you'd be living in an RV in Portland with a meth dealer in the back wanting to kill you and pimp out your girlfriend. That's my point. And being, you know, told that from your heroin dealer.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? Like, at least, right.
Look, my heroin dealer is looking out for me.
Right.
You know,
well,
like
also,
that.
You know, I mean, friend, but also business. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So what happens then?
So that freaked us out. And we moved out of that. We got out of that. We still had this.
Well, I think it would freak you out.
We still had this station wagon that we were driving around. So we did have a car to live in, and there was a mattress that it was just more comfortable in the RV, and that's why we moved out of the back of the station wagon with the mattress. After that, I think it was a couple weeks after that, my girlfriend had enough, and she called her parents in Cincinnati, and her dad, you know, bailed her out, got her a plane ticket and got her on a plane to fly back.
And she stayed here.
And she moved back.
Okay. So that's towards the end. Like,
when is not towards the end.
It's not.
I still stayed there for a couple more years because I had no way back. I was still
so
like,
she was able to leave.
My parents were, you know, they're like, no, we know what's going on. We're not enabling you. You're going to ride this out, you know? And, that just meant like I would find another enabler, you know?
Right.
And so, you know, I've been you know, I'm able to make friends pretty quickly and stuff. And, you know, it's Portland. So there's a lot of people that are homeless. And since, you know, I have a car and, you know, it doesn't look that bad yet.
Right.
You know, it still does, but I'm a heroin addict, but who isn't, you know, it's
right,
Portland,
you're saying.
You know, everyone's on heroin. Yeah. So I'm still like kind of holding it together. You know, I'm in this band, you know, like the type of band that has like 15 people on stage, like one of those, like every kind of like someone playing a triangle and a tambourine, and you got two tambourine players, and you know, so it's one of those things. And you know, the lead singer, you know, he OD'd and died in bed, and his girlfriend found him, you know, and we're still keeping the band together, you know, and just, you know, insanity.
The fact that you were in a 15-person band, the lead singer dies of a heroin overdose. Like, how, I mean, you're living in your car, right?
Or yeah. I think had gotten in with this group of people, and there was this this girl that I eventually started dating. She was able to get a mortgage by scamming a bank. She didn't scam the bank. She, you know, she could afford it. She just, you know, she was a hairdresser, and so she like was able to get like a mortgage on like a $250,000 house somehow. And it was, she had horses, like she would rescue horses, and there was a pasture and there's a barn. So we just got, she would just take these free horses off of Craigslist and, you know, like,
and rehabilitate them.
Well, they were, they, you know, people were like, we love this horse. And, you know, they'd come look at it. Okay, you can have our horse that we love, you know. And we, so, It was just weird. There was like Shetland ponies and stuff. And
I can remember you telling me a story one time. Like, you also would do odd jobs, right? Like a lot of your drug use. Like, what are some of the odd jobs you'd do? Remember you talking about like, didn't somebody like live on a commune, or like a lady that you go and do some woodwork for, and she'd paid you in carrots?
Oh, that was when I was a kid. But yeah, that was
tell me this crazy story.
Well, this is, you know, back when I, this is a long, like when I was a young kid, but she was a crystal child, you know, her name was Carol Jean, and, you know, they would, I don't think they had electricity, but they had like all kinds, you know, they had like a greenhouse and like an orchard, and like, you know, I remember spending like 2 days out, like helping her dig up all these carrots, you know, and she's like, "Oh, I'm going to pay you, you know," and she fed me dinner and stuff. And, you know, I'm thinking that she's going to give me some money. And she, you know, she ended up like giving me like, you know, 20 pounds of carrots.
And you're a kid. I'm like, thinking, what am I going to do with all these
carrots?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. So.
And she didn't have toilet paper.
Yeah, yeah, right. There was no toilet paper in the bathroom. There was this little basket filled with corn cobs.
I mean, dead serious. I believe you. I mean, every time, like when I heard you tell me that for the first time, and I know it relates nothing, but it's one of those situations in life. I relate not on. I could just tell you this, like my brother Eric and I used to mow people's lawns, right? And we'd do it together, and then we would split the money. And this lady lived on a hill, and it was a good 70 degrees. It was ridiculous, right?
Wow.
So maybe 60, but it was pretty much straight up and a pain in the ass. She said, I need somebody to, you know, mow the lawn. And Eric and I are like, we can do it. She said, how much is it going to cost us? And, we're like, Eric and I agreed, like, you know, I think a good $30 or something like that. She's like, well, I can't do that. She said, I'll give you guys $20 a piece, right?
Yeah.
Like, whoa, you know what I mean? $40, like this is a big win. And, you know, we cut the grass, it takes us forever. Like it's a nightmare. Like there's no, I'm pushing Eric from behind to get the lawnmower up the hill. And we get done, and she said, you know, well, we got to get home. We're going to walk this entire thing. She's like, just leave the lawnmower. I'll get you guys home. And we get in, and she said, but you can't sit in the front seat. That's the dog's seat. So Eric and I are sitting in the back seat. This dog's in the front. She said, oh, my goodness, I don't have. She hands us a $10 bill. And Eric and I are looking at each other, looking at her like, I thought you just said $20 a piece. She said, oh, well, you know, you guys took way too long to do that and all these. I was like, Eric and I were so mad that she just gave us $10 to cut her grass to split, mind you, not even $10 a piece.
Yeah.
But just, it was the worst day of my life. I'm serious. People are jerks.
Oh,
and I had to sit in the back, and she paid me, you know, half of what she said, or a quarter of what she said she was going to pay.
I mean, how can you take advantage of, like, kids like that? Like, people that are like that, oh, my God, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, unfortunately, she didn't pay. Did you remember, like, did you just give someone the carrots or what?
I think I ate all of them.
20 pounds
I was
of carrots.
Pissed. I'm going to eat these effing carrots, man.
Right.
I'm going to get my $20 here.
$20 worth. Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I loved carrots. I did. I think maybe that's my problem. I was talking about how much I loved carrots.
Because I'll just pay him in carrots.
Well, he'll appreciate, you know, these. They're organic.
Right.
It's organic.
You know? So is the toilet paper. So, you know, I know we rewound that plenty back, but here you're in a band in Portland. The lead singer dies of a heroin overdose. And without missing a beat, you guys said, we got to keep it going, right? Or what?
Well, it was kind of fizzling out. You know, there were other, like, people that were starting to die of heroin overdoses in our circle, you know, around. And it was
that fairly regular
out there. It wasn't that regular out there. Not like it has been here in the past few years. So because the lead singer OD'd and died, it was like, it became like everyone that wasn't on heroin, they were all like, you know, Jesse, we really care about you. We know you're doing this, and you know, we want you to stop. And like, just like, that was like the first time that like I felt like cared about, and these people were like, you know, their solution was, you know, smoke a lot of weed and drink a lot to stop, you know. And but they, just the fact that they were there, we care about you and we want you to like stop doing this because we don't want another, you know, friend to die. That was like I felt this like spiritual connection and motivation to stop doing it. And I did, you know.
Did you get sick and everything? And do you remember? I mean, I know that sometimes it's tough to.
It wasn't super bad. I mean, I was high on weed and drunk to help, you know, and that did help a lot. And I think there were some type of like Valium or something involved too. Like, there was a lot of stuff to help me get off of it. But just having people around that like cared about me and wanted me to stop really helped.
And that's huge. I think that's a. I understand that a lot of the families that are still dealing with someone who's still struggling, they just want their family member to stop. They love them. They don't. I mean, we want these people to be around. And sometimes it gets as bad as like people just accept the fact that that's who you have become. And like, oh, well, that's Jesse the heroin addict. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That's unfortunate too. But I think it's important when you start to identify that and say, for what seemingly first time you brought up in this conversation is this desire to change some pattern of behavior here. And while you filled it with other things, the more acceptable, like, which people always say, like, why, hey, just go drink. I don't care if you drink. I don't care if you smoke weed. Just don't do that. And that's a fair assessment. I think a lot of people would say that. However, what I've learned in my own recovery and a lot of other people I know, including you, is that all of these substances, no matter what it is, can create severe problems.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. It all leads to the same.
And that's the thing. I mean, especially now that you've experienced heroin, weed and alcohol, did that take off more so?
Well, here's another crazy story. So we're living out in this horse farm and that's kind of deteriorating. The IRS is now coming in on this girl like, okay, you claimed that you made, you know, $100,000. Well, now now you owe us $20,000 in taxes, which she really didn't make that much. She was just trying to get the mortgage because she, you know, so the IRS is coming down on her. People are moving out of the place. And so I'm like one of the last ones there. And there's, you know, this is like backcountry Oregon, and there's the neighbor is like this, he's got a meth lab, which was just weird. And so like, you know, I go from heroin to like then being isolated again, because she would go to work. I lost a job because I like the last, you know, I was still on heroin, and I'm working at the for this company, and they noticed something was up, and they're like, you need, you know, we know what's going on, because it's real prevalent out there. Heroin's real big, so they knew that I was on heroin. They're like, you can come back, but we want you to get clean. So I was jobless. And so now I'm isolated. No one's out there. I'm all alone on this in the country. And there's this meth lab next door. And so, you know, so I got into that, which pissed off my girlfriend.
That you were had at the time, right?
Yeah. The one that was that, that got the mortgage on this like little cottage farm thing. She, you know, threw me out. And I'm a drug addict. And so what do? I think, okay, who's the next person I can, you know, mooch on to keep this going? And so I call up my girlfriend who's in Cincinnati. And, you know, I rekindle that relationship. And she's
over
like,
the phone?
Yeah, over the phone. And she, well, sort of. She wasn't like, you can move in. She, you know, I knew some other people down here that, you know, and she was like, yeah, come on back, whatever, you know, you can stay with, you know, my friend Wit. And so I like,
moved. She still cared about you.
Yeah. You know, so I come back, she's still on, opiates. And so that was immediately, you know, back to the,
right.
Off
she's
to
doing
the races.
What I'm gonna be doing. I get that.
Off to the races. We're, you know, hanging out again, and now I'm meeting all her connections and stuff, and off to the races. And then, you know, I was living on this guy's floor. He's an alcoholic and he knew what was going on. He's like, I don't care. You need to stop doing that. And it was another thing where he was like, I don't care if you drink, you know, you have to stop doing that. Stay away from that bitch. She's destroying you, you know? And so like I kicked again, I got off heroin again. And,
for about how long you think?
Not long, probably 6 months or
okay,
so.
But still, but
and then, you know, it was just,
heroin.
You know, this roller coaster of getting on and off, getting back together with her, getting back on heroin, opiates, whatever. And living couch surfing, living in different places, just not, you know, not stopping anything else, like maybe stopping heroin for a little bit. So then finally, she lands this apartment. She's no longer living on her friend's couch. I'm no longer living on my friend's floor. She gets this apartment from a friend who was like, I can't afford this anymore. And so, you know, I'm working. I had a job. She had a job. So we take over this apartment. Now we're living together. We're both on heroin. And somehow, miraculously, she gets pregnant. And that was like,
I can tell you how it happens if you don't know.
But. I know, but like if you know anything
about heroin,
opiates,
right,
it's how do you, it's weird. Your libido is completely gone.
Not only that, but also women like end up not even having periods too.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
Yeah. Right. And so
I want to make sure I do the research on that before, but I know that I've been around women that were heroin addicts that hadn't had a period in months.
Yeah.
Because it messes up their bodies.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know, so
she gets pregnant.
So she gets pregnant. And, you know, so now I'm like, awesome. You know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, okay, because I'm still going along with people pleasing. I'm still like trying to go along with it. Also, you know, if it's in front of me, I can't say no kind of a thing
right.
at this point. And that had never, like every other drug that I've ever done, it had never been like what it is with heroin. It's a whole other ball game.
No doubt.
Being physically addicted, not being, you know, I never had that before. And it's, you know, I thought I was smarter than it. You know, I think, you know, I'm this narcissist. I think I'm smarter. I can outthink anything. I could not outthink opiates. It destroyed me. And so, but there's this glimmer of like hope in me, like, okay, she's pregnant. Like we can get the family to know what's really going on. We can get them involved, you know, everything, you know, this can finally stop.
Yeah, be cohesive and a family unit. We can get right.
This we can get right for this.
Because now all of a sudden I've got to be more responsible. Now all of this other stuff, hey, I have to put it behind me. I have a kid on the way, right?
Yeah.
And then you're going to make the your thought processes. I'm just going to stop all that. This is going to be the best thing ever.
Yeah. But I didn't want to just bail on the situation because, you know, like most heroin dealers, they're all, if it's a woman's involved, they're also looking for like, I can pimp her out. I have a hoe right now. You know, I wanted to make sure that her parents fully knew what the situation was. And she got into a place before I did, you know? And so I was kind of waiting it out, and the opportunity came up where her parents knew what was going on. We needed rent paid. And so the ultimatum was, okay, you can take this P test. And, if you pass it, you know, we'll pay your rent. But really it was this big trap, you know, she's 7 months pregnant. Obviously you can't hide that anymore. So they knew everything was going on. I knew, I was like, yes, do it, because I knew she was going to fail it. I knew all the cards were going to fall, you know, so this was the opportunity, and it was. And she got into a treatment facility for pregnant women or women with children. And then that's when I got on the phone with my dad, and I was like, okay, you know, I need to go to rehab, and
I need to lick this. I need to get this right.
Yeah. So I, you know, I go to a treatment facility up in Columbus.
Okay.
And that was my first experience with
what recovery is supposed to be, or
with a treatment facility and rehab.
Right.
Again,
right,
I told you earlier, this is like my dad's choice of recovery. And so this was a faith-based
teen challenge type thing.
Treatment.
Got it.
And it was good, but it wasn't like a 12-step program. They felt like all I needed was
Jesus,
the Christian Bible, and that was going to be enough. And that just reminded me of like how I was brought up, like with Christianity shoved down my throat. So it was like a turnoff. I wanted to be off drugs. That's about it. But I didn't know how to change my lifestyle. I didn't know how to get around people who were trying to better their lives. I was still addicted to the lifestyle of partying, and those are the only people I knew. So, I learned that I could take a bunch of hand sanitizer and drink that, and I would, you know, fail. So I knew like there were, this,
gosh,
okay, this
is gonna be disgusting.
This rehab was, it was like this working rehab. It was free, but you had to work, like, right. So
kinda
eventually,
like a Salvation Army.
Yeah, after like your 28-day spin dry detox, they would put you to work, and it was like 1 week on, 1 week off, and they would take your entire paycheck and give you, they would save up like $80 out of each paycheck for when you left, if you made it to like the one of the final phases. There was different phases and levels. And so half of it, we were in this farm in the middle of nowhere in Sturtevant, like near Athens, Ohio,
right,
near the University of Ohio. And so we're way out there. And then the other half of the time we're working for this concrete foundation company, like pouring, like
just doing tough work.
Yeah. Like very physical work. And it was like, I was like getting resentment. I'm like, this is slavery. Like this, I should be making, you know, $20
an hour.
They're
probably
doing
making
this.
That and then paying you guys.
But and the owners of the treatment facility owned the concrete company.
Oh, there you go.
So they are making millions of dollars off of, you know. So I got a lot of resentments for it. So anyway,
I think it's important to talk. You know what? Like, I'm going to make something very clear to my listeners. Like, there are people in positions to say, I'm going to provide a treatment center. This isn't it. I'm helping you, and I'm going to put you to work. I'm going to give you a job. And they basically are taking advantage of people, though, too, because it's like, what's your life worth to you? You're getting clean and sober. And while I understand that to a point, we're also grown men, right?
Yeah.
And for somebody to make an like off the backs of somebody else in such a, I could see, I have a resentment now because of what you're telling me.
Yeah.
Because I know that this exists. I know this exists across the country and people are taken advantage of because of their positions in life. Does it make it right or wrong? In my opinion, it makes it wrong. It's wrong to do that to people.
Yeah. I mean, if they were saving more than just like, if they were saving the money I earned, like maybe subtract, you know, something for rent once a week, but like not like here's $80 off of like a would have been a $900 paycheck, you know, and here's $80 of that. Like that was ridiculous. You're profiting like that huge.
A lot.
And so anyway, I found out that people that were relapsing while there would get a bus ticket back home.
Okay.
People that just wanted to leave, they would, here's your bag, walk 20 miles to the town, you know? So I was like, okay, I'm going to drink this hand sanitizer, get drunk on it, and then they'll buy me a bus ticket back to Cincinnati. So I did that. And then, you know, obviously it was awful.
Yeah. What's it like drinking hand sanitizer? Was it?
It's like, I mean, it's, you know, 98% alcohol. So it's like drinking moonshine. It's like, and it's, I didn't drink very much of it. And I was like bombed. Everyone, because it was a bunk style dorms, there's 20 people in a room, you know, and they all could smell it immediately. I walked in to like pass out and then I'm, you know, thinking back, I'm like all these other guys who are in trying to get their lives together. And I'm like triggering them, you know, that was really selfish of me. But maybe it like reinforced, you know, for them what they were doing. And, you know.
Yeah, you don't know how that affects. I mean, because I can tell you this in my own life, especially this last go around, when I see people and even currently I see people, I feel for them. I don't feel jealous of that. I don't feel like, oh, I wish I felt high because I've gone through that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, man, I really hope they get it together. And thankfully, I don't have to be that guy today. So you never know.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But anyway, that your story is that. So you get that bus ticket. You walk the 20 miles to town.
No, I didn't have to because I drank the hand sanitizer. They gave me a ride.
Oh, well, that's
to
great.
Get the bus. But I had to take, you know, they gave me a bus back to Columbus. And I was, you know, my final destination. I needed to get back to Cincinnati because I had, you know, friends that, you know, my good old using buddies that were still like, we got a spot for you. You can crash in my place, you know. And my son was born now. And another thing, they didn't let me leave to go see my son. And that, like, I had a brand new son. And the whole point of me even being there was to go be a dad. And so, like, I, you know.
It's tough.
So I wanted to leave really bad, you know, and obviously I wasn't like spiritually or mentally prepared to not, you know, live the lifestyle of a drug addict at that time. And so I moved right back into, you know, back on someone's couch, back on someone's floor. And I stayed, you know, clean and sober for a couple months and then it just kind of creeped back in. You know, I wasn't surrounding myself with people that were trying to do the recovery thing. I was surrounding myself with the same people, same broken
people. Well, because that's all
people
you've ever really known. I mean, and you obviously resent the people that you were hanging out with up at the treatment center. I mean, you had a level of, because of the faith-based part of it, there was some resentment and how that was all done. Mm-hmm. You go back to, this is what you have to go to.
Yeah, that's all I have.
You don't know, you don't have any preparation saying, oh, I'm going to go stay here or there. I mean, this is, and I see that. I know that because I've experienced it too. We can't change the world, and it's going to be a lot more difficult for you to have a life of recovery going right back to the same environment that allowed the addiction to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
And so now you're back. You have a little boy, right?
Yeah.
Your quote-unquote girlfriend is getting some type of treatment still.
Yeah, she's still in this, home for addict mothers. And so she, you know, I still didn't, you know, they don't let anyone over there.
Man,
they have visits, you know, I can go visit for an hour during, you know, this time. So she was still there for another year and a half while I'm like getting back into, you know, drinking on the regular and smoking weed and doing whatever else is in front of me. And so like, I'm just, you know, back to my old self, you know, not on opiates. But, you know, using nonetheless. So year and a half, she's finally ready, you know, and I'm just like this big mooch.
Yeah.
You know, all of this, all the whole, I do work and I can pay rent and stuff, but I have no like renting history or anything. So I have no ability of getting anything on my own. So I'm like relying on her to like find an apartment basically. And, you know, I'll come help with rent, you know, once you find one. And, so she did eventually. And, you know, here comes Mooch. He's,
yeah.
He's got his, you know, his bag full of junk, you know, and so I, you know, I move in with her.
It's like the path of least resistance, right?
Yeah. But, so day one, first, you know, she's been there like 2 days. Day one, I come over and I noticed that she had track marks on her arm. So she's,
obviously
she's doing the mat,
yeah,
medically assisted treatment, but she's also, you know,
supplementing it.
Yeah, supplementing that. And so I wasn't 100% sure. And so I didn't realize what was going on, but my addiction was running the show already behind the scenes. And I somehow like get a tester off of some dope boy. And I was going to entrap her with this, like, oh, I noticed that she had track marks. So I was going to put her on the spot and be like, are you using again? You know? So I find this tester, I bring it home and I'm like, well, I got this tester. Do you have, you know, do you have a needle? Do you have a rig? You know? And she immediately came back out with one and, you know, and instead of like
doing what you plan to do,
doing what I plan to do, I, you know, I did it myself and then it was off to the races again. And, but this was the last time, that I did opiates.
Isn't that wild though? Hold on. I'm going to make something very clear, right? Cause you said something and I find that like your mindset, you know, you get a tester from a dope boy. Mm-hmm. And you just moved in with your girlfriend who you know is getting high. You haven't been yet. You've been doing other stuff, but not this. This is the evil thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get back home and you think, I'm going to, because I want her to like self-admit that she's doing this.
Yes.
But my only way to do that is to trick her into it with dope in my hand. So you go, hey, look what I got. You know what I mean? We'd like to do this. She comes back, confirms your suspicions. You already knew. But instead of saying, we need to get help. You're like, let's do this.
Yeah.
That's the insanity of it. That's the power of it. And people may hear that and think how on, well, it would have been.
I don't even think she did it. She was like, oh, well, that's not enough. You can just do it. And I was like, well, okay.
Right.
I didn't even do it with her. I did it myself. All like.
That's insane.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I had a situation that I posted about last week and I was at a gas station and a guy pulled up. My brother seems to think maybe it was one of my old dope boys. I don't think so. I don't know. Guy pulled up in a car and threw a bag of dope at my feet and said, hit me up. And I was like, what the heck has just happened? You know what I mean? Like, just can't even believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And I kicked and had a number on it. And I left and I'm thinking about it. Not thinking about using it. Just thinking about, like, all the progress, all the other things. I would never even, but, like, the thought of using it didn't cross my mind. But I also recognize at one point I would have picked that bad boy up. And it would have been in me that within 10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this thing that happens, and you made a very strong point to that. It's not good to be walking around with dope if you're a recovering heroin addict.
Yeah.
Just saying. Like,
yeah,
it's just, and, you know, I got it on. I mean, it's just silly. People are like, you should have picked it up and given it to the cops. Like, no, I didn't even want to touch it.
Yeah.
You don't even get it. Like, well, a kid could pick it up. Like, what kid's hanging out at the gas station around gas pumps? If there's a child hanging around there, he's got, I mean, I don't know how that would work out. But anyway, so now you're off to the races, and this gets towards, like, where things.
Yeah, and so this is kind of getting towards the end. So I'm just the only one doing it. She's, you know, on methadone. She's doesn't want to lose the kid. Like when she had custody, but CPS is still involved because knowing, you know, they kind of oversee and make sure. And so she's like, I don't want to lose our son. And I'm like, okay, you know, well, I'm addicted again here, you know, so I would like go to work and I would, you know, do my drugs like away from the house. I was like regularly using bathrooms downtown and over the Rhine. And this is like within like the few months that fentanyl started to come around. And I actually that year I OD'd probably 5 times, like hospital, ambulance ride, OD'd, Narcan'd. And then like the final time I was at the downtown library in the stall, and I was woken up by a sheriff, and he didn't take me to jail. He just handed me my felony, you know, court date. And so that was a wake up call, you know, for me. I did still use for a couple weeks, but I was calling my mom and I was like, I just need a place to detox and I can do this. I can get off opiates at least. I've got, you know,
now you have this felony over.
I've got this felony over my head. And so I was in like drug. I was just going to the court dates for what seemed, it was probably
forever,
a year.
Right?
It was literally a year where I was just going, I was still drinking. And you know, that was the whole thing. They were just like, we want to test to see what you have. So I went down and I detoxed, down with my mom for Thanksgiving for like a week. I got off of opiates. And so then I came back to like do the drug court thing. And so I was still, you know, drinking and smoking weed, and just constantly failing these
urine screens.
Cause that's what they do. They want to see what you're on. And so I got like my initial, ruling was I was going to do IOP, the outpatient,
which is intense outpatient program.
And so intensive outpatient. So I'm like, I thought that was just retarded. It was the dumbest thing ever, you know, and I wanted something else. I was negotiating with the judge of what I thought I needed. And so this went on and on. I would get signed up for IOP, not show up, and then get kicked out of it and have to like start the process over. But every time you start the process, it takes a couple months. So that's why it was like a year later. And finally, a year later, they are like, well, okay, you obviously can't stay clean. We're going to lock you up in this court-ordered treatment
facility.
Right. And so, and that was the only way, you know,
to really separate you
for to get me to do it. And that was like my first interaction with actual like 12-step recovery. And, you know, I had no idea. I had to be handcuffed. I had to be forced to go do this. I had to be locked down, you know, and I was in that facility for almost 6 months.
I remember.
It was a 90-day program. I was in there for almost 6 months. And,
it's not easy. I'll go based off of my, perception of that time, because we were in there at the same time,
mm-hmm.
and we developed a friendship. We were roommates.
Yeah.
I mean, you slept right underneath me for a while.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things that was, I believe, difficult for you at the time was that it was important for you. You had this family. They want to let you do what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it bothered you so much, and you just couldn't like just let it be and just accept it for what it is. You just had to find a way to go. If they said go right, you go left.
Yes.
That was like your thing. And I'm like, Jesse,
I had to have some control over
you
it.
Had to, no matter what it was, like it would be so baffling, so ridiculous, but you're like, no, because I have to do it. And, you know, and then we have the other aspects, like, you know, we both did mental health and these other things, and you know, they're trying to make sure because they want to have you be successful. That place, look, in my opinion, it's not really set up to, it's just a dry out period, right? And while recovery came in there, what else besides that was the recovery? Wasn't much, in my opinion.
No.
You and I would talk about that. We would have conversations because that was more recovery than all what else, with everything was going on. There's mm-hmm. just like a bunch of grown-ass kids hanging out, playing, you know, working out, playing ping pong, playing video games, listening to music, watching movies. That's really what the days existed of. It was,
yeah,
it's,
yeah, riding out your time.
Yeah, just riding out,
jumping through the hoops and
saying what they want you to say and all of those things because, you know, I'm grateful. I had a spiritual experience while I was there, right above the bed where you were sleeping. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Literally, early on. And I don't know if you remember me walking around with that, listening to Christian music all the time. And
oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It was a big deal to me.
I remember that. And I wasn't there. I was just learning what it was for me was how do I get this felony dropped? And so, like, that's...
And I get that.
And that's all it was for me. I was like, okay, I can get this felony dropped, then I can just go back to the good old days where it was just weed and alcohol, and I can, you know, and that's like, and so I did, you know, I stayed clean for, I think, 18 months, and I successfully
completed that program.
Completed
right.
Drug court, but the night of graduation, it was like, I've gone, you know, so long. Oh, I deserve, you know, and I go and smoke some weed and it was like immediately stupid, you know, it was just, I was immediately around these like immature, just dumb fuck, you know? And
it's funny cause I know a lot of people that did the same thing. I was just like, come on guys.
Yeah. And it was, but that experience, that 18 months of working the steps or at least being introduced to them. I don't know how honestly I worked them. And I feel like it was, I didn't go far enough into depth, but I was like, I liked all these connections I made with you, with other people. It was like the first time in my life I was making real connections with people and going through life, something difficult with other people. And it builds these like strong bonds with these, with fellowship, with these new people that are,
that you know, you actually want the best for you.
Yeah. And you're trying to do this thing clean. You're trying to change your life. And so being around other people that are trying to change your life makes it so much easier for you to like change your life too, because you're all on the same page. There's no like, this is what we're doing now. And that was my first interaction with that. So drug court, is done. And then I'm going to go back to smoking weed and drinking. Within like 2 months, I was back on, I was back on paper. I got a misdemeanor for, breaking the phone of the mother of my children. I was drunk and I threw her phone against a wall. And so I'm back on, you know,
as a direct result of your
right, yeah, drunk and being, right. You know, and because that's, you know, I was used to like this one, I was used to being high on opiates, and then we're trying to like get back to that with alcohol. There was no in between. Your blackout, like you're trying to get, you know, that messed up, and like that's what happens to your brain, is like that's why it's a progressive illness, is because there is no like going back to how it was.
Well, yeah, the good times of it. When no, you first, right. None of that.
Your brain remembers like that feeling and it wants to get back to how high you were. And so.
So you got new charges.
Got new charges.
And as a result of that, now all of a sudden you're back into the mix of going down the court. Oh my gosh.
So I'm back. Yeah. Right back on. Number.
Yeah. Just spending all that time.
Yeah, I just spent like 3 years in total of like dealing with the court, and so now I'm back on it for another year. But this time, like I go through being in drug court, I had these connections, which, you know, it really helped. I had all these numbers I could call. I had all these people that I could call and ask for support, and like, you know, so I go. This program called the Fatherhood Program. I called them because I wanted to see my children because I was separated from them. I had a restraining order now and I wanted to like at least get visitation rights. So I go to them and I'm like drunk when I go in, and the the guy I was speaking with was like, listen, you need to get dried out first before we're ever going to do anything. So go check yourself into the treatment center downtown. And so I got a reserved a bed. I had a date that I was going in, and I was so happy that time to go in. I was so ready, and it was like on my terms. I didn't have to. Court wasn't making me, you know, at the time. I wasn't on randoms or scheduled drug tests. That came later, but I wanted to, like, I was doing this because I was a huge piece of shit and I did it, you know? And so I remembered how good it was, how good it felt to be in recovery, and I wanted that back. So it had to be on my terms. I didn't have enough experience, so now I'm doing it for myself. And so now this time it's been totally different because the whole time I was ready and I see where my addiction takes me. And I see, I saw, like, I learned, like, play the tape forward, you know? And like, what does that look like? Well, I looked at it through the eyes of my children. And here I am, this like deadbeat dad that's drunk all the time or on something and not around. And I was like, I don't want to be that. I never wanted to be that. And that's a motivation in itself. Like, play the tape through. This is how I get when I'm around anything, when I'm on anything. This is what I do with it. And so it's all or none.
Right.
One is too many, a thousand's never enough. So this time around, I've lived like the way I've done it for these 14 months is one day at a time and just for today. And the serenity prayer is huge. And I'm able to not control things, not control people around me, not manipulate. And when I don't get my way, get butt hurt about it. And so I'm learning these spiritual principles and genuinely seeing them work in people that have more time ahead of me, more clean time ahead of me. And like, it's working for them and I want what they have. Like, I see the good that 12-step programs have done for them and I want that. So I'm taking their suggestions. I'm doing everything I can. If there's a big life decision now, I ask people that have had experience in it, have more clean time than me. Like, hey, how
would you do this?
How would you do this?
Right.
Even like doing this podcast, I was like, should I do this podcast? And they were like, well, you should, you know? And some of them were like, you shouldn't, but most of them said you should.
Trust me, I know not everybody's a fan, but I don't see why you couldn't be.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, you want to keep certain things anonymous and you want to, you know, I see why that is. And, for people's safety and my own safety and whatnot. But so, today, you know, here I am talking about like the last 14 months, you know, and how my life has completely changed because I want it to, and because I'm taking these suggestions, because I'm staying connected with other people that are doing recovery, working the steps, and living like by spiritual principles. Like I was trying to say earlier, it's like I own my actions now. I see, like, yes, so you may have done something that caused me to, you know, made me feel like I had to act a certain way, but I own my actions and I own my part in the situation. And and that's all I can do. I can't like say, well, you did this and you did this, which, you know, I did this and that's, I own what I did. I own up to my actions and I see my part in it. That's what I'm trying to say. Right. I own my part in the situation.
Because that's what it's about. Like, you being able to see how you affect other things, or how you let something affect you or hold on to it or whatever it may be. Like, look, all that external stuff, you know, mother of your children, family, job, all that stuff is outside, and it still can cause us to have resentments.
Mm-hmm.
But holding on to that resentment is our own fault.
Yeah.
And we also recognize, like, well, what part did I play in that? Is it because of me? If it isn't, then I just got to recognize that people are sick. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think that's strong, and I think it's a really good point that you bring up and you say. I mean, for the past 14 months, your life is able to grow and become something more meaningful because of the appropriate steps that you take in order to surround yourself with like-minded people, work a program of recovery, talk to people. I mean, and just be a genuinely good dude. Now, that fatherhood program worked with you to be able to get you back in the life of your family, correct? Mm-hmm.
Working towards
it, right?
I didn't complete that program, but just having, you know, they were a connection that pushed me in the right direction to get me where I am. To say, you know, the first part of, you know, they didn't say this directly, but to be a father, don't come in here smelling like booze.
Right. And I think, well, that's fine. So you can just still say yes. What was the catalyst? You walked away from that. You're like, I have to do this. I need to be a good dad.
I was seeking help. I was looking for it for the first time ever. I surrendered. I said, I can't do this alone. And that, like, that was the most freeing thing. And it, like, that's like, stop trying to control stuff. Stop
trying to overthink it.
Trying to find a successful way to use the right combination of whatever to, like, to successfully get high and have no consequences. Like, stop doing that. Once I got to that point, I took drugs and alcohol off the table, and I've
never put them back on there.
You know, they are not even an option. And that now it's like easy. Once you do that,
it's crazy.
It's easy.
I tell people that all the time. They're like, so, I mean, it's just that I have the choice, but that is not an option. Out of mm-hmm. all these decisions I can make, drugs and alcohol being on the table are not the option. For many reasons, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was my solution for years, but it's not a solution now.
True. So, Jesse, what I ask of all my guests, I would like to ask of you as well, if you could say something to someone who is still struggling, what would that be?
What I do every day is I live just for today. I, like, all I can do is not use right now and moment to moment. And that's what keeps me going. I can't think about the overwhelming pile of wreckage that I've created. I just think about right now and what I need to do right now. And that is not pick up. And before I knew it, I was less depressed. I'm not depressed anymore. I thought I needed to be on, you know, whatever. I thought I needed some medical solution. But I stuck with it. I sat on my hands. I listened, and I did it day by day, and I still do it day by day. I don't see that changing ever. I see it as the only way to be, you know, living for right now. I do plan, but I guess that's a lot of words.
No, I think it's beautiful. Jesse, thank you for coming in on this Saturday morning. To all my listeners, you guys are awesome. We just hit over 5,000 streamers or followers on Facebook. Episodes are doing well. We have now, I believe this will be episode 45, which is so wild. You know, big things in the works, working on the website and some other aspects. But thank you to all my international streamers, people in Cincinnati. By the way, I don't know. Just thank you guys all for making this show a part of your recovery. If you're someone who is the family member of someone who's struggling, you know, it can get better, and it will. It'll be something. Law enforcement, let's go. I mean, there's a lot of different people who listen to this, but I want to thank you guys for taking and making this a part of your life. To everybody else, and as always, do big things.